drawing room over here.
You made it. Oh, come on through. Do you fancy drink? What's your tipple?
Welcome to The Drawing Room, a space for intimate and surprising conversations. I'm Andy Park. Whether it's can't we all just get along, or maybe even agree to disagree, not everyone embraces an argument when and where it arrives. But Lee Siegel argues that argument is essential, not only to the individual, but to art and to society. It leads to change and helps us understand the world. Whether that argument plays out in political platforms or in art or increasingly online, it's a way of seeing the other side and convincing them that your point of view is better. Lee has mounted his own arguments everywhere from Harper's to The New Yorker and his own book, Why Argument Matters. And Lee Siegel joins me tonight here in the drawing room. Welcome to you, Lee. Come on in and take a seat.
Pleasure to be here.
You made the distinction between an argument and a quarrel and a debate. What defines an argument for you? And would you say, or would others describe you as an argumentative person?
That's a great double-edged question. Well, I'll take the first part of that. The difference between an argument and a quarrel is really a combat between two egos that really don't give an inch. It's kind of, the conclusion is foregone. An argument, on the other hand, is it's driven by the desire to fully understand the opponent's position, to understand the opponent's position and state it even more clearly than your opponent does. Empathy is a very important part of argument, even if it's used as an instrument of destroying your opponent's arguments. A debate is a kind of formal ritual of disagreement. It follows along kind of mechanical lines, like presidential debates here. Each debater has a certain amount of time to answer a question, to make a retort. It's very highly regulated, whereas an argument is more organic and spontaneous. And as far as me being an argumentative person, absolutely. my old friend Norman Mailer told me that I was a counterpuncher just like him, which was very flattering. Of course, I'm not just like him, but I am a counterpuncher, and it's not always helpful, but that's how I am.
Well, that's high praise indeed. I suppose I just want to be clear that this isn't just a trick of language, that we call different arguments different names because perhaps we just don't like that form of conversation or the topic area that it gets into.
Right. No, I think arguments, we call all sorts of things arguments, and when two romantic partners argue, when they quarrel, it's called an argument. But I think when you're thinking about it in a serious way, you want to make fine distinctions. And I think argument belongs in a category to itself.
Well, it does remind me of what I would call the conversations in my house. My wife might call them quarrels. I mean, you suggest that argument is an autobiographical process, that the way we argue tells a bit of a story about who we are, a bit of a window into our souls, if you like. What do you mean by that?
Yes, very much. You know, Freud said that the way people have sex is an expression of their personality. I think arguing is like that. We argue along the lines of the shape of our life. Our arguments are driven by all the things that made us who we are at that moment. I think argument is a very profound reflection of who we essentially are.
You also point out that Aristotle was an early proponent of argument, but you also suggest that there are sort of good and dark sides to his work. What are the dark sides of Aristotle and of argument itself?
Well, it's interesting. You know, in America, people are constantly lamenting the decline of argument, into a mere morass of feeling, a morass of emotion. But for Aristotle, that's all argument was. It was the art of manipulating your opponents and your audience's emotions. That's all it was. He wrote about the importance of logic and evidence, but what really carried the day was hitting your audience right in the heart. And Cicero took that even further. Cicero kind of dismissed the whole idea of presenting facts and evidence and appealing to reason. No, for him, it was all about feeling. Like Mark Antony's speech in Julius Caesar, like Shylock's speech, "Hath not a Jew eyes?" But those are arguments, and those are arguments that really depend on stirring up the most powerful emotions.
But if Aristotle was alive today, wouldn't he say that that sort of pathos technique is almost overused, that when it comes to arguing or trying to manipulate someone's point of view, that modern culture's almost set aside the logos kind of technique? It's purely pathos now. And there's something to be said about what's lost in that, would you say?
Absolutely. But I do think that there's a kind of a Trump lie going on here. There's a kind of distortion of optical distortion of perspective because of social media, because of how amplified social media is. It seems like the entire world is social media. But in fact, you and I are having a very civilized conversation here. Each of us has a kind of argument to make. Even your questions are arguments. My answers are arguments. Op-ed columnists make careful arguments. Politicians make careful arguments. Statesmen. I do think that argument is still alive and well, and Aristotle would recognize that. And he would see the pathos churning away in the internet after he recovered from the trauma of Twitter. He would see that as simply, well, you know, as he in his own formulation, the mob, right? You know, the feelings rising from ordinary people.
I often think and even say that it's the people that you disagree with the most that you need to be kindest to. And you mentioned empathy before. What is the role of empathy in an argument? And in one sense, if you are not empathetic, how could you ever win an argument?
Well, that's right. If you're not empathetic, how can you really do so much in life, right? You have to inhabit other people's perspective in order to be kind to them, yes. But you also have to inhabit other people's perspective in order to win in a situation, to win as a lawyer, as a business person, to win in love, to take that romantic object away from someone else. You have to make a kind of argument or to win that romantic object's heart. I'm using object because I don't want to get specific about gender. I think that empathy in argument, well, I'm kind of cynical about it. It simply helps you carry the day.
If you call it a weapon, in fact.
Yes. If you understand what your opponent is feeling, what the very emotional sources of their ideas are, all the better for you to convince them or at least to vanquish them in the eyes of the audience. Empathy is not necessarily something good. Sympathy is good. Empathy can be something cruel. The most empathetic character in literature is Iago, who understands and who feels Othello's emotions right down to their origins and uses them to destroy Othello. Empathy can be an instrument that leads to sympathy, that leads to kindness. But in the realm of argument, I think it's simply it's an effective way to connect deeply with your opponent's way of thinking.
Which sort of brings us neatly to Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal, which was such an effective argument. Why was that? In terms of that incremental rationalism, if you like, tell us about Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal.
Yes. Well, you know, the English overlords who were ruling Ireland believed that they were ruling Ireland. This was before utilitarianism, but they believed that they were ruling Ireland in the most rational way, rational sort of cost-benefit way possible, that the beauty of their ends justified some of the cruelty of their means. And they were perfectly content with that because they never followed the cruelty of their means to the bitter end. But Swift did follow the cruelty of their means to the bitter end. He created the horrendous spectacle of devouring your children for dinner. This is essentially what the English overlords were doing to Ireland. They were devouring Ireland's resources and its human and its material resources. So he was merely taking their argument to its bitter, cruel conclusion. He was more them than they ever thought they could be. And when they read him, they must have been horrified to see see the consequences of their intentions in full bloom.
Lee, we often hear complaints these days, perhaps pointing and blaming social media for this, that we can't have a reasonable argument anymore. And I would posit that that is due to the exploitation of pathos over logos. Is there any truth in that, or is that just an eternal complaint, if you like, that every generation would complain that we can't argue like we used to?
Well, there's certainly a natural tendency in political life, for positions to harden. And the means of conveyance, the means of production, as it were, really has a lot to do with how information and argumentative positions are conveyed. The means were once modest, right? Pen and pencil, just speaking in a coffee house or on the hustings or something like that. Now they're highly sophisticated along the venues of social media. So social media amplifies the natural tendency of people to harden their views and to retreat into their own egos and be perfectly content to be sitting in their own egos. So I don't think it's worse than it ever was, because human nature doesn't change. But I think it's more the sort of negative sides of human nature are amplified by the internet. It does make it harder and harder for distinctive voices that speak with reason and sanity to be heard. Absolutely.
On ABCRN, I'm Andy Park. Lee Siegel is my guest tonight here in the Drawing Room. We're talking about his book, Why Argument Matters. I mean, you make a very interesting point that in America, individuality is the highest good. It is the highest totemic that's worshipped, if you like. And because of this, ad hominem attacks on oneself, become more common and also a bit more feared, if you like. How do you think that embrace of individualism has shaped arguments and the American perception of it?
Well, that's a great question. Well, I think that one of the products of the internet is solipsism. One of the pitfalls of highly developed individualism is solipsism. And I think this natural American tendency to, you know, celebrate the autonomous individual, the sovereign soul that Emerson spoke of, I think now it's tipping into its opposite. You know, the enemy of every system is its perfection. And I think the individual is reaching the height of perfection in America. And that's what's destroying it. Individualism has just run amok, and it's having the effect of destroying what it means to be an individual.
And to extend this idea, given the importance of empathy or at least placing yourself in your opponent's shoes, does that become more difficult as individualism is raised to be the highest good? Your inability to empathize sort of diminishes your ability to argue.
I think that's true. I think people become more fragile. I think as the individual sort of becomes so huge and is about to burst, I think people feel more fragile than ever before. The threshold for slights, the threshold for sort of enduring all the bumps and bruises of life is lower than it's ever been. The use of psychiatric drugs is universal. People have to numb, I'm not saying this is a bad thing, but people have to numb themselves more and more to reality in order to make their way through it. Someone once spoke of the herd of independent minds. Now you have sort of the crowd of solipsistic souls. You have vast mobs of people, but they're all trapped in themselves. You know, one of the weird things about the January 6th insurrection was that, I think it was horrendous, and I think it was a disgrace. However, all these people were kind of out of themselves and unified around a cause. It was an ugly cause, just as fascism was an ugly cause, but it was kind of something new in American life. It reminded me of, on the other end of the spectrum, the left-wing radicals in the 60s who gathered, you know, in Washington to levitate the Pentagon. You know, I hadn't seen that kind of solidarity and that kind of escape from solipsism in a long time.
I want to talk about arguing across an imbalance of power. Is it possible to do that? There is a lot of talk in this country, certainly, where if you don't have a lived experience, then you don't have a stake in the conversation, if you like. And therefore, there are not two equals, if you like, to conduct an argument. So is it possible to bridge that divide across an imbalance and have an argument across it?
Oh, that is such a question now. You know, power power plays itself out in so many ways. We have cancel culture. I guess you have cancel culture there to some extent. It's it's a worldwide phenomenon. Well, that's all about power. That's saying, look, we're not going to argue because X has a platform and Y doesn't. You know, Y is X's student. Y works in X's law firm. The power dynamic is too transparent and too uneven to have any kind of arguments. So let's just talk about abuse. And let's talk about degrees of abuse and degrees of pain. And then let's talk about degrees of retribution and punishment. So what used to be the sort of nemesis that argument tried to ward off, conflict, now becomes the substitute for argument. And yes, it's very, very hard to get started. Empathy doesn't work. Sympathy doesn't work. It's not just that you can't write about something unless you've had that experience. You can't write about a certain group's experience if you're not a member of that group. And that's really a shame, because how can people join together to change their lot in life if they don't bridge the barriers between groups, if they don't find commonality between them? But the struggle for power, as it plays itself out in cancel culture, is one of the things that makes arguments really very, very difficult. It's just dismissed as another ploy, as another instrument of privilege, and it's discredited.
What are the limits of an argument? You point to Frederick Douglass and Martin Luther King Jr. as men who knew how to not only mount a powerful argument, but also understand the limits of the approach.
That's right. And here's where power becomes an essential part of argument. And here's where you have to acknowledge the limitations of argument. You know, King had a few debates, on a few televised debates, a few public debates. If he had just contented himself with debating, nothing would have changed. No, he had the March on Washington, the Civil Rights March, and he massed enormous numbers of Black people in Washington. And what he was saying was what Baldwin said, the fire next time. Either you give us what you want, what we want, either you treat us with equality and dignity, or you see all these Black people peacefully gathered here, they will destroy your society. That's what Baldwin meant by the fire next time. So I think King understood that there were limitations to argument. And even his idea of passive violence, it was meant to incite violence. It was meant to allow Americans to see Black people, Black children, having their heads beaten to pulps. And that's not an argument. That's force used against itself. And I think Douglass had the same, he wasn't in a place where he could deploy all these things, but I think he had the same feeling about the limitations of rhetoric, the limitations of argument.
Lee, in the last part of your book, you look at the arts and you write that art is not judged by its truth or its validity. Art is judged by the strength of its claims to be. So are you saying that the first argument a piece of art must make is that it of its own a claim to existence? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's right. A work of art has to convince you that it is just as alive as you are, as the situation you're in. It has to convince you that not only that, but that its parallel reality is perhaps even more alive. You have to be taken in by it. You have to surrender yourself to it. You have to substitute it for your own reality. It's a very powerful claim that art makes. It's a stupendously audacious assertion of authority. That's why I do believe there's a kind of suspicion of art in a way. That's why art is pushed into these kind of pious, woke, if you will, niches now, because art itself is simply too inarticulable, too inestimable, to sum up in rational ways of thinking.
Of course, theatre is not confined to just the stage. Tell me about your encounter with the wife of Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito at his confirmation hearing.
Oh yeah, a magazine sent me down there to cover his hearings. The hearings, and At one point, he was asked a question about abortion, and his wife suddenly jumped up. She'd been sitting in the gallery, and she rushed out of the room. And of course, all the reporters ran after her, and I ran after them. And I found myself face to face with her. She reached the end of a long corridor. She reached the wall. She turned around, and there I saw her eyes were absolutely dry, not a tear, and she was smiling. It was all meant to distract everyone from an argument in progress, or from any kind of argument at all.
Well, is that not an example of the pathos being so much more powerful than the logos? I mean, tears will win over, you know, intellectual barbs these days.
Absolutely. I don't know anyone really who's been won over in any situation by a beautiful turn of phrase, or by a rational formulation that goes right to the heart of the matter. I think it's gestures, it's looks, it's faces, it's, you know, think of if you've ever been in therapy or even in psychoanalysis. I was in therapy with a serious psychoanalyst, Freudian, for a while when I was younger. And just the way he lifted his eyebrow made a point. Just the way he looked at me or looked away or looked down, everything was a theater. And everything had an import, and everything influenced the way I was thinking about myself. And I think arguments like that, too, puts the audience on the couch, you know?
So what of the future of argument, if we've discussed where it's come from and where it stands? Where does the argument stand in the future in terms of its relevance in art, literature, society, and politics?
I think in a healthy democratic society, people will keep arguing. I'm afraid that people might see how argument has become, too widespread, too common, too loud in social media, and then try to discredit the practice of argument altogether. That way lies fascism. That way lies totalitarianism. As democratic society becomes more fed up with its own democratic energies, it might well seek to discredit arguments in the name of some ideal of argument that's never existed. I'm afraid of that, because there are a lot of people on both ends of the spectrum here in the States, left and right, who really just kind of, they're tired of argument. They just want to tell people to shut up. It's a kind of response to a certain, you know, an excess of democracy. As democracy becomes more individualized, more raucous, more amplified by social media, it begins to revolt some people, and they want to kind of put a stop to it. And I worry about that.
Well, Lee, I certainly agree with your friend Norman Mailer. I found you thoroughly argumentative, but also thoroughly agreeable at the very same time, which I believe is somewhat the point. It's been an absolute pleasure to have some time with you in the drawing room. Thank you so much.
The same for me. An absolute pleasure to be here.
Lee Siegel has been my guest in the drawing room. His book, Why Argument Matters, is out now through Yale University Press.
You've been listening to a podcast of The Drawing Room with me, Andy Park. For more great conversations, search for The Drawing Room on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.